It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we want to focus on two significant developments having to do with U.S. news media this week. The suspension of NBC Nightly News anchor Brian Williams a little bit later in the program. The announcement earlier this week, Jon Stewart will be leaving The Daily Show. In 2013, as a guest on David Letterman, Brian Williams paid tribute to a soldier who had provided security to the anchor and his NBC crew in the desert in 2003. Here's what he had to say in that broadcast.
We were in some helicopters. What we didn't know was we were north of the invasion. We were the northernmost Americans in Iraq. We were going to drop some bridge portions across the Euphrates so the 3rd Infantry could cross on them. Two of our four helicopters were hit by ground fire, including the one I was in.
No kidding.
RPG and AK-47.
What altitude were you hit at?
We were only at 100 feet doing 100 forward knots because we had these massive pieces of bridge beneath us on slings.
What happens the minute everybody realizes you've been hit?
We figure out how to land safely, and we did. We landed very quickly and hard, and we put down, and we were stuck. Four birds in the middle of the desert, and we were north out ahead of the other Americans.
Now, Williams also brought up the story last month on his nightly news broadcast. After a video of the segment was posted by the network on Facebook, several soldiers called out Williams for stretching the truth. Williams, it turned out, had not been on the helicopter that was hit by an RPG. Williams apologized last Wednesday, both on Facebook and on Nightly News.
During the Iraq War invasion, I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago. It did not take long to hear from some brave men and women in the air crews who were also in that desert. I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft. We all landed after the ground fire incident and spent two harrowing nights in a sandstorm in the Iraq desert. This was a bungled attempt by me to thank one special veteran and, by extension, our brave military men and women, veterans everywhere, those who have served while I did not. I hope they know they have my greatest respect and also now my apology.
However, Brian Williams' apology last week seemed to raise more questions than answers, and the controversy swelled in the days that followed. Skepticism mounted over Williams' claims about other reporting assignments, namely his coverage of Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. On Friday, NBC News said it would conduct an internal investigation into the disputed accounts. Then a couple of days ago, we heard that NBC News announced Brian Williams will be suspended for 6 months without pay. Later in the program, we want to address the journalistic aspects of this story with Michael Bougea, director and professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, also with Lyle Muller, executive director of the nonprofit Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. But first, let's talk about the psychological aspects of this story with Jason Chan. Jason is associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. His research looks into human memory and also false memories. Jason Chan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, it's possible, of course, that Williams was lying about this stuff all along to puff himself up as a journalist. But we're asking in this case with you, could his serial misstatements also be the product of some ordinary, unintentional memory distortions?
I think that's certainly the case. It's definitely possible. If you look at the sort of the evolutionary history of how the story got told over time and how it changed over time, it is pretty consistent with what we know about how false memory tends to develop.
Okay, so walk us through a little bit of that timeline that tells you that it may be consistent with what we know about false memories developing.
So for ordinary people, when you experience something, we don't remember everything that we experience. We remember bits and pieces, little things here and there. And then when we retrieve information, we take these bits and pieces of information and we sort of connect the dots. And depending on how we connect the dots, the story can change. And we've all had grandpas or grandmas who every Thanksgiving we tell the same story, but every year the story gets better.
Right, yes.
And they genuinely believe them and treat these as genuine events that had actually happened to them. In the case of Brian Williams, you can sort of see how the story get better and better over time as well. And in this particular case, it's just so happens that because he's a journalist, because the original event was reported widely and there were video evidence of it, it's really easy for us to go back and check the source. In most real life circumstances, this, you know, there are no records, and he's not certainly not the only person in the public that have had something like this happen to him. Ronald Reagan had an incident about him when he was running for president, and he would repeatedly told this story about World War II that happened to not had happened, except that it was in a movie that people had seen in the 40s. Hillary Clinton has something similar happened to her as well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question, though, is here in this case with Brian Williams, is he likely then, when this happens, conscious of the story changing, becoming embellished, or is this something that can happen unintentionally?
Whether it's intentional and whether it's conscious, I'm not sure those two things are really on the same dimension. You could be unintentional, but sort of conscious about it. But
doesn't that distinguish between a lie and just a misremembering?
Right. If it's intentionally sprucing up the story, then it could be considered a lie. In his case, I can't know for sure whether he's genuinely remembering it wrong over time. But it is certainly possible if you look at how his case compares to other famous cases in which it's clearly a lie, like Lance Armstrong. He, in his case, when inconsistencies were pointed out to him, he almost immediately accepted it and sort of offer an apology.
Lies about his use of performance-enhancing drugs.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. We know why? What drives this? What drives memories to become distorted?
A lot of this has to do with the way we remember information, and I've said this briefly before, that we only remember little things like bits and pieces. And the retrieval process itself, when we recall information, is fraught with errors and malleability. When we remember things, remember little pieces of information. And there are many ways you can connect the dots. Mm. And if your objective is to tell a good story, and I assume when Brian Williams is talking to friends or on talk shows or in sort of public speaking events where he's not reporting the news, there will be situations where the objective is to tell a good story. And when your objective is telling a good story, it's easy to connect those dots in a way that is inconsistent with the truth.
Or not only connecting the dots in a different way, but creating extra dots to make a better line.
That's certainly possible as well, yes. That's one way to think about it.
Are some people, do we know if some people are more prone to misremembering events from years past?
Yes, there are certainly cases, there are studies that have been shown that there are plenty of individual differences in susceptibility to false memories. It's unclear exactly what drives these individual differences. One thing is, even within the same person, you could sometimes be more susceptible and other times less. Sleep deprivation, there's a recent study that shows that sleep deprivation is a key contributor to developing false memories. In general, anything that reduces your attentional capacity is going to make you more susceptible to false memories.
So in this case with Brian Williams, certainly we use the term fog of war. He was in that theater of fighting in Iraq, and of course the soldier's experiencing a lot of stress, but he was experiencing that as well. That may be part of the explanation.
I think that's possible. The relationship between stress and false memory, it's a tricky one. In fact, the relationship between stress and memory itself is a tricky one. Sometimes stress enhances memory. Sometimes it makes your memory very foggy. In fact, you could not remember anything at all if the situation is extremely stressful. So it's a complicated matter. In this case, I think repeatedly telling the story over and over would likely have an effect on him developing that false memory.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say enhancing memory, because we're in periods of high stress. I can think back to when I saw an impending, I was in a car that was about to have an accident. And you can say, well, that lasted maybe 5 or 6 seconds, but every bit of that 5 or 6 seconds was somehow recorded as if in high definition. That's what you mean, right?
Yes. Although that does not necessarily mean that you cannot develop false memory for something that is extremely memorable. It is the idea that we sometimes think that our memory, when it's sort of feel like it sort of etched in your brain,
mm-hmm.
that you have sort of printed this scene, that you feel that for this particular memory is infallible. And that's not true. We have seen over and over again evidence against this idea of so-called flashbulb memories. Of very highly emotionally charged events, people think that they remember every bit of it, but then over time, you track their memory over time, they change as well.
Mm-hmm. So this has implications in a lot of fields. Testimony, I think you're referring to, when we say we witness a crime, or we say we recognize someone committing a crime, that we know more and more about how that could be derailed.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are the big unanswered questions in the field of memory?
Well, we have a lot of unanswered questions. And I think one of the key questions that people want to know the answer to is, how do you tell whether someone's memory is genuine or not? And that's a big topic of research, and I think this is going to be a pretty difficult question to answer. But, you know, with continued research, I think there's a possibility that we can crack that code.
A couple of years ago, I'm sure you must have seen the film with Leonardo DiCaprio, Inception, the premise of that film being that you can go into people's memories and insert other memories. Any truth to that?
Actually, something like that has been shown in rats. You can actually do it in rats.
You can do it in rats. How mm-hmm. do you remember enough to tell how they inserted it in rats?
I believe you can. I mean, with the current technology, some of the molecular biology stuff, which I'm not an expert in, you can actually directly control genes expression with light, and you can actually use that to create a memory in a rat.
What about getting rid of painful memories that we might have? Are there techniques to do that? I've talked with, for instance, Holocaust survivors. Some people deal with very painful memories, and it might be better to continue living without some portion of their memory.
That's a highly controversial topic. We talked about that a little bit a couple of years ago. And there are evidence that in psychotherapy, different types of psychotherapy, techniques that can reduce the impact a traumatic memory have on a person. There's a lot of different opinions about whether it is possible to make people forget a traumatic memory. I certainly think that with the malleability of the brain is a possibility.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few seconds left. Can you tell us how we better protect our memories, how we guard against implanting false memories in ourselves?
Pay attention to your surroundings.
Pay attention to your surroundings.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
It's the easiest for us to forget and to come up with false memories when the original information is not encoded or learned well. And one of the key contributors to that is we're just trying to do too many things at the same time and not paying attention to what we really need to remember. And attention is a really key. If you put bad, you know, or weak things in there, you're going to get weak things out. The idea is that if your memory originally is encoded weakly, it's much harder for you to remember it later, and it's much easier for you to distort that memory later.
Okay, we have to say goodbye for now. Thank you very much, Jason Chan, Associate Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University. Fascinating research on human memory and false memories. Thank you very much, Jason.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we want to address the journalistic aspects of the Brian Williams suspension. Has this sort of thing ever happened before in the national media? Does it deal a blow to news journalism as a whole? We'll discuss these and other questions with Michael Bougeya, director and professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. Also with Lyle Muller, executive director of the nonprofit Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking this hour about two significant developments in national news media this week. One, the suspension of NBC News anchor Brian Williams. A little bit later, we'll talk about the announcement by Jon Stewart that he's leaving The Daily Show. Joining me now to talk about these developments for the rest of the hour, Michael Bougea is director and professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University in Ames. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Lyle Muller is with us as well, executive director of the nonprofit Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. Lyle, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
Just what did Brian Williams do? Well, if you've just joined our program, in multiple public statements over the years, Williams has said that he was aboard a helicopter that came under fire by a rocket-propelled grenade, an RPG. Well, in fact, he was on a separate helicopter that followed up to an hour behind that first helicopter. Last week, he admitted he'd gotten some crucial facts wrong, and he apologized. Earlier this week, he was suspended for 6 months without pay by NBC News. I want to ask you each for your initial reaction. Michael, tell me, what did you think when you heard this news?
I thought it was a sad occurrence. I really did not believe it was going to take on the life that it has taken on, essentially because, journalists have been telling war stories, real and imagined, for a long time. And I thought, okay, he goofed. But I never put Brian Williams as some sort of Walter Cronkite icon. He's not up there with Merrow or Cronkite. And I think that the media's reaction to it, which was quite swift and quite harsh, made me step back a little bit. I never realized that this was going to blow up the way it did. And since that has occurred, I have really contemplated what had happened. And I wanted to add, at least in this broadcast with you, Ben, something new that hasn't been said before. And I think I see differences in this type of event than might have occurred with Dan Rather and those memos about George W. Bush's time in as an airman. You remember that scandal. This seems a little different. There are two similarities between the two cases. One is that shortly after the 60 Minutes broadcast, which was in 2004, September in 2004, if I'm correct, immediately the conservative internet's listservs and chat rooms began to question that report and the authenticity of those memos. And that was a relatively new thing in 2004. Facebook at that time had just been launched as a very small venture at Harvard at January 1st, 2004. But the internet really played a role in causing the public to take a hard look at Dan Rather. The interesting thing about the Brian Williams scenario is who framed it. It was really framed by social media, specifically Facebook. And I think there's a tipping point here. And we'll listen to what Lyle has to say. I mean, the tipping point for me was mainstream media typically would put something out as an agenda item and frame that topic, if you will, like the Affordable Care Act, for instance. And then the internet and social media would light up with opinions. But in this case, you know, we saw challenges to Brian Williams' story on Facebook. And then two things occurred to me about this whole scenario with Facebook and social media. On the one hand, journalists have always been telling these types of stories and exaggerating them as time went on, but they never really did it to any large extent in public, as our friend and Iowa State University alumnus Terry Anderson said when we chatted about it on Facebook, ironically, was that, you know, this is what reporters have always done, but they've done it in taverns, so everybody thought they were lying anyway.
To embellish themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, but this happened on air in public, and it continued to happen on air in public. And the interesting thing for me, Ben, is how Facebook started to frame the national media in a way that I really hadn't seen before. Two things about that. Number one, we're living in an age where if you are a public figure, particularly if you're an elite public figure, and I would put Jon Stewart as an elite public figure way ahead of Brian Williams. He actually makes more than 2.5 times the salary of Brian Williams. Brian Williams makes $10 million, I think, a year. And Jon Stewart makes anywhere between $20 and $25 million a year. He's one of the highest paid celebrities. The interesting thing about this, though, was how social media, on the one hand, has a history of taking down the elite. And it did a really good job on Brian Williams. And that's the plus side about social media. But the not-so-nice side about social media is the tone in which they take people down. And that tone, the more I looked at what was on social media and how national correspondents and newspaper writers were responding to it, they took on the same tone of anger, disbelief, to the point of Jon Stewart making a very nice satire about it a few days ago when he said, finally, someone is being held accountable for the war in Iraq. Mm. And so that was the real eye-opener for me, Ben, is that this is a new media environment, and mainstream media had better pay attention to social media's power and the power to frame what the mainstream media is reporting.
Interesting. It's almost like they've grabbed, you're saying social media, the internet has grabbed the reins of the power to frame a story. And this may be a tipping point which can demonstrate that. Lyle Muller, on this point or others, your reaction to the suspension of Brian Williams and this scandal?
I think three things come into play here. One is the fact that by virtue of giving an incorrect version of an event that happened, he actually told a false story. In other words, the news story itself, this was a news event, right? The news event was wrong, and for that, he needed to be held accountable. We all make mistakes. Reporters make mistakes. Now, this was not on the level of Janet Cook back in the day when she cooked up an entire story and won a Pulitzer Prize for it. But it was a fabrication of a story, or at least a false telling of a story. A second thing is the standard to which Brian Williams is held. And I would agree with Michael that the days of Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite and some of these other people who, by the way, Brian Williams looked up to as a young kid, he's still held to a standard. It's the number one rated network news program in the evening, and there's a responsibility that goes with that. The third thing is this notion, and this gets into what Michael's talking about with social media. There is a segment of the population of the United States that really wants to skewer NBC, and they're mad at them because these are the folks who are mad at people who skewer Fox News, all right? So there's this liberal-conservative split, and NBC is the enemy for a conservative side of the United States because of MSNBC. So I think those are three things that come into play here. Now, the fact that there is an embellishment in television news comes nowhere close to shocking me. This is an industry in which reporters rely on producers to do a lot of legwork, at least on the network level, and then the television talent comes in and does the report. Now, I know I'll catch flack a little bit from local television news reporters because, in fact, at the local level, they do reporting. But when you get to a higher level, there are producers who are out there doing a lot of the work. And so you come in and you can't believe that they do all of this work. Anderson Cooper doesn't do all of his reporting. He observes, but there are producers and other reporters who are helping them. So it's an interesting discussion, and it's a good one because it just kind of shines light on what are our standards, what do we expect. I think perhaps the thing that's coming to a fruition here is we're transitioning a little bit and realizing that perhaps television news anchors are news readers instead of news reporters. Other people are doing the reporter. The anchors are the ones who are telling us this information in a way that we like to hear as an audience.
Mm-hmm. How much, Lyle, is this a blow to journalism as a whole, not just to NBC News?
I don't think it's much of a blow. We make mistakes all the time. An interesting thing is that Brian Williams is being held to this standard, but there are other news media where they make mistakes all of the time. on cable news under the guise of saying, well, they're not reporters, they're announcers. So you hear things off the cuff, and people aren't being punished for that. Brian Williams is for his mistake, and he should be. I don't think it's a blow to journalism. I think that if you can weather things as the Janet Cook incident that I mentioned, which was now some 35 years ago, the Jason Blair incident with the New York Times, when he was fabricating whether or not he was interviewing Jessica Lynch. Talk about an exaggeration of where I was. He said he was there interviewing this woman. He was nowhere near them. And so that was in the New York Times. We've been able to survive these. I think the truth comes out in the end and wins over. It's actually amazing how accurate journalism can be. If you think about, we're trying to find the truth in a lot of times a quick amount of time, and it's actually amazing how much we have accurate more than how much we have in error.
Does Brian Williams have a future at NBC News as an anchor anywhere else before we change topics here slightly? Michael,
yeah,
you first.
Yeah, I would like to do two things. First of all, what Brian Williams is going through, what NBC is doing, is kind of a strategic move by NBC. Today's show had a segment on it this morning. He's going to have 6 months unpaid leave, during which time a very good journalist, in my view, Lester Holt, will take over the anchor chair. And this gives NBC a couple of options. If Brian can think of a way to win back the audience's trust, oh, they'll probably stick with that brand. But if not, you will see someone sliding into that anchor chair, and you'll see Brian Williams announcing he has a new career venture that he's going to do. But I want to follow up something about journalism. This is close to my heart, and it is close to Lyle's, too. Lyle and I are friends and colleagues, and the idea of journalism and how bad it is to journalism is just so much puffery. It's so politicized. This morning I was reading a piece in the Huffington Post, and I thought better about commenting on the Huffington Post because the people there would not respond well to what I was going to say. And it's a takeoff on something that John Stewart said when he said, finally, someone is being held accountable for Iraq. Well, this columnist did the same thing, and everyone was commenting about how journalism is this or journalism is that. It's all politicized, and we got into the war because of warmonger journalists and so forth. And I was going to remind the people of the Huffington Post that 30-some-odd journalists were killed in Iraq, getting the truth that they now see as a politicized truth. The fact of the matter is, journalism is not only alive and well, journalism is the mainstay to this country's fabric. Journalism also is what I believe people want more of. There is a kind of anger about Brian Williams that I also put to something greater, that people want more journalism, they want better journalism, and they don't want to see these types of incidents anymore. Be interesting to see what Lyle has to say.
There is a need for journalism now that exceeds perhaps any time that I've been aware of. Certainly, it exceeds anything in my lifetime. And that includes during the Vietnam War era when we were trying to learn what was going on there, when the government was keeping it from us. And the reason for that is that there are so many voices out there who are telling us things. We want to know what the truth is. And journalism, good journalism, should tell us what the truth is. So I think there's a strong need for it. And the idea of people out there putting their lives on the line, that's pretty dramatic. It happens, and it's all because of someone trying to seek the truth, something that's wrong, and they want to tell people about it.
Lyle Muller is executive director of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. Michael Bougeia is director and professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, talking about a couple of developments in the national news media this week, Brian Williams being suspended. John Stewart, we wanted to give him some attention in the 5 or 7 minutes we have left of the program. Earlier this week, Jon Stewart announced that he will be leaving The Daily Show.
It's been an absolute privilege. It's been the honor of my professional life. And I thank you for watching it, for hate watching it. Whatever reason you were tuning in for, it you get in this business with the idea that maybe you have a point of view and something to express, and to receive feedback from that is the greatest feeling you can ask for. And I thank you.
Lyle Muller, let me start with you. What is the legacy of Jon Stewart? He's been at it 16 years. He's changed quite a few things.
He started a genre, if you think about it, and it's the cable news programs that take serious looks at the news, but with a flair of comedy, taking a look at some of the hypocrisy that goes on. If you think about looks at the news back in the old days, and not dating myself here, but say Saturday Night Live, you always have had the Weekend Update, and there's been some truth in those things, but it's usually jokes. George Carlin, the hippy-dippy weatherman, I mean, all of these different things. The interview with the 1,000-year-old man, they're comedy, they're meant to be funny. But Jon Stewart raised the bar on that, and so you have him coming out with things like that, and now you have John Oliver and Stephen Colbert and some of the programs that they've done where they take real serious looks at the news but try to point out the hypocrisy. And I would argue that in some of those instances, they've been able to drill at the truth of the matter better than mainstream reporters. And the reason for that is they're not afraid about worrying about, do I have balance? Do I have this side? Do I have that side? They're just drilling in for the truth. So I think that's his legacy.
Michael Bugier.
You know, Jon Stewart is part of a long tradition that goes back to 1729 and Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. And for those who have a literary bent, you should read it because Jonathan Swift set the standards for satire. And I think many people don't realize the power of satire. Satire has a couple of common attributes that harken back to Jonathan Swift and A Modest Proposal. And that is, you must use an unreliable voice. So look how Jon Stewart delivers his news. It's always unreliable. He's leading us to believe that we're going to have the greatest moment ever, and then he shows a news clip, and it's quite a letdown. So he has mastered the unreliable voice. But what satire does is expose truth, and exposes truth in a very specific way. It exposes the truth that all of us know but don't want to acknowledge or say. And that's a tradition in the United States that goes all the way back to Ben Franklin. So, yeah, while many people think he's the greatest, he is actually a satirist. And that is among the most difficult types of journalism to do. But it is journalism, and it is the truth. We mostly see it in editorial cartoons. And the talent of Jon Stewart is how he creates editorial cartoons that we can watch.
Has he changed the landscape in a way that will extend beyond his presence on The Daily Show?
Well, look, college students love satire. They attempt to do satire, and they usually mess it up. All right, so it's really a draw for younger audiences, and I think The Daily Show is very good for journalism because it introduces news to the younger generation, and many of those will continue on to consume news. So in that respect, The Daily Show has been a huge boon to the practice of journalism. And the public's perception of Jon Stewart as a journalist is and Brian Williams as a journalist is very interesting. There was a Pew Research study in 2008, and Jon Stewart turned out to be the fourth most popular journalist in the country right after Brian Williams. So there is a confusion amongst many about what is a journalist and what is a celebrity. And that really is at the root of what we ought to be thinking about with these two cases.
Got a couple minutes left. Let me ask this question to you, Lyle Muller, at first. Can you laugh at The Daily Show regardless of your politics, or is this only a laugh for liberals? Primarily.
Well, it's a big laugh for liberals, but if you really, really have a good sense of humor, there's also very funny stuff there. And so I can tell you that I laugh at stuff that pokes at things that are sacred to my point of view if they're funny. So he is funny, and I think that's kind of the key. You know, when I was at the Cedar Rapids Gazette, I worked there for a long time. And I always thought that one of the things we ought to do to get people to read newspapers was have a column the next morning that explained all of the stuff that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert talked about the night before.
Right, right. It is. The show is funnier the more you are informed. You keep yourself on abreast of current events.
Exactly.
It's not funny in the humorous sense. It's funny that we are laughing at ourselves for not acknowledging what is so obviously he puts on the screen. It's not a comedy show. It's a satire show. I would disagree with Lyle on humor. The thing about what Jon Stewart does and is a master of is showing the hypocrisy. And he doesn't only show it about the left. That's a misperception. Some of the most biting satires he's done has been on the Obama administration, most recently about Obama and John Kerry not going to France to mourn the victims of terrorism. He takes on everybody that is apt to be taken on, and I watch it mostly to understand what he's exposing and what media really isn't covering very well.
Well, when you look at the clips that he reels out, he must have tremendous resources and an archive to pull within hours juxtaposing video clips of the same person contradicting themselves, don't you think, Michael?
He uses all sorts of journalism no-nos, like false light. In other words, taking a picture and doctoring it to make a Republican leader look like a turtle, for instance. And that really, this is a historical part of journalism that people overlook. This dates back to Benjamin Franklin, one of the best satirists and journalists that this country has ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Final words about Jon Stewart as we close the show?
He's able to do it quickly. His staff is able to work on deadline and produce something that's timely. And that's also something that makes his program relevant.
Jon Stewart has done for journalism what we all hoped he would, and that is engage an audience under 40 and introduce them to the very important aspect of our republic, and that is journalism that reports the truth so that people can make intelligent decisions in the voting booth.
Thank you both so much for your insights here on these two news media developments. Michael Bougeia, director and professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. Lyle Moeller, executive director of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. I've really enjoyed hearing your reactions to these news stories about the news media this week. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.